News Talk 1400 KFRU is proud to present the KFRU Heritage Series with David Lyle. It's a one-hour perspective on the events and the people whose lives have contributed to the heritage of Boone County. Listen each Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. as we celebrate those who have become part of our history. The KFRU Heritage Series from News Talk 1400 KFRU.
This Heritage Show, we're going to talk with Skip Walther, who is an attorney in town, and you'll know him from various roles that he has played in this community as a very involved community personality. It's nice to see you, Skip. How are you?
Great. Glad to be here.
And I should also say some people will remember him as a former regular person on KFRU. Because
true.
You did the, that was like a 6 to 7 show, was that not right?
Yes, something that's
like
right. That. Yep. Couple nights, 3 nights a week.
What was that like?
It was a lot of fun. I mean, for me personally, it was a whole bunch of fun. My dad was a KFRU radio announcer when I was a very small boy, and so getting the opportunity, having the opportunity to do a radio show, is very sentimental for me, and was just a whole bunch of fun. But it was a political talk show or a contemporary events talk show. And I'm not Al Jermond. I cannot bloviate for an hour without anybody else talking. But to prepare for that, I had to read every newspaper I could find: the Times, the Post-Dispatch, the Star, the Cleveland, whatever that
Plain
was,
Dealer.
Plain Dealer. That's it. L.A. Times.
Yeah.
Just to have material in the event nobody called in. But the goal was to say something provocative enough that people would call in, and even if they didn't agree with me, I didn't care, because you want the back and forth, and you do this enough. It's a lot more fun when people are calling in and giving you grief or agreeing with you than it is when you're having to talk all by yourself.
It's interesting because you just bring up a point that I would be curious to know. As an attorney, you have to deal with people who are not always in the best of mood. And as a radio talk show host, which depends on calls or interaction with people, you learn that the same thing happens, which is tougher. I mean, I have learned by what I get to do not to take things personally and not to go on the defensive too soon. You just can't. But I would think that you came to radio already having learned that job through your profession.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did. And you're right. It's really not. It wasn't hard. In fact, to some degree, having somebody disagree with you made for better radio than having somebody agree with you all the time, because you've got a difference of opinion. Your people are coming from different perspectives, and people can recognize or understand that. From an attorney standpoint, you're right. Every lawyer is dealing with people not in the best of moods. And that's tough, because if it's your client, you've got to steer them in a direction that you think is in their best interest, and it may be a direction that they don't want to go. And that's difficult, because then you're dealing with people's rights and their livelihood sometimes, their family status, and so the consequences are more significant, or are significant. On radio, it's you can disagree, so what?
It's air, and
right.
It goes out there and it vanishes after a while. I want to talk more about your attorney work later on in the program, but I want to get back to talking about the radio, because what you said is a very good explanation of when you come into a studio and what you're doing and what you were doing then is different than what I do. I've got things that I can go to, a high rotation of a program elements. But if you come in, news ends at 5 after 6 and the next news comes on at 7, you got 55 minutes where you're looking and saying, okay, what's going to be important for people to hear and maybe to respond to on that particular night?
Right. That's and hopefully people call in. And when there's a phone bank, obviously people can't see that, but these things light up. And when all three phones are lit up, it's a good time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what you said, your father worked at KFRU. I don't think I was aware of that.
Yeah.
Tell me about what he did and when that was.
He worked at KCG. Al knows all this, of course. He worked at KCGM, which was Columbia's Key to Good Music, I think.
Wow.
And he also worked for KFRU. And he did music shows. So he would play jazz, and there would be news and local events. So, but he did that for a living for a few years.
Really? During the day? He's on daytime?
During the day, yes.
Now, did you ever come to the station at that point in time and hang around?
I did, and the most fun I had when I did that, back there, there were tapes, you know, these spool tapes, and they reused them. But to reuse them, you had to erase the language or the music or whatever on the tapes, and to do that you had a magnet. It was a electromagnet that was, you know, plugged into the wall, and so he let me use the electromagnet to erase these tapes. And as a, you know, 8 or 9 year old boy, that was a lot of fun.
I'll tell you this, there was a talent to doing that. There are wrong ways and right ways of erasing those tapes.
Well, I'm confident I didn't do it the right way.
Oh, I'm sure you probably did, or else you would have heard from people. That was that the time when Malin Aldridge was around? Did you have any memories of Malin Aldridge as a kid?
I met him, but I don't have any memories of him.
Skip Walther is our guest on this Heritage Show. All right, before we move into some of the other good things that I hope we talk about during this program, I told you I was going to start with tennis. Well, I didn't actually start with tennis, but it's close to the beginning of
the
show. I can remember hearing about your tennis playing and that you were a tennis player, and I thought that was really something that I thought, wow, I was jealous, because I think anybody who has that as part of their life, and that was a point in time only 10 or 15 years ago, that's pretty neat. So tell me about your love of tennis and your involvement with tennis.
Well, I started playing tennis in Kirksville, which is, that's where you went to school.
I was born in Kirksville. I wasn't living there, but born in Kirksville. I have a lot of fond memories of Kirksville from a lot of time up there, yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to exactly say that. I went to...
Wait a minute, what's wrong with Kirksville?
Well, I went to Russell Boulevard Elementary, and then my dad died when I was in sixth grade, while my mom was a legal secretary here, and she had to raise me and my sister and I. Well, she was able to get a job in Kirksville as a legal secretary, paying about the same amount of money. But, of course, the cost of living in Kirksville is so much less than it was in Columbia. And so we moved to Kirksville, and it really wasn't what I had in mind. And coming on the heels of my father dying, it was a disruptive event. And Kirksville is not Columbia. Yeah, I mean, obviously.
No, it is not.
And so, you know, there are not a lot of things to do in Kirksville. I played ping pong every day after school, because the junior high was right next to the college, and they had the student union had some ping pong tables, and there was a gaggle of people who loved to play ping pong, and so that's what I did for a couple of years. And didn't do too bad at it, and then started getting into tennis and played with Scott Sims, who was the basketball coach's son, who later came to MU and played basketball for the University of Missouri. And we played every day during the summer for 3 years. I just loved the game, and came down to the university, got a tennis scholarship, played on the tennis team, and have continued to play competitive tennis since then.
Did you graduate from Kirksville High School then?
I did. I'm a Kirksville Tiger.
Yeah, Kirksville Tigers. I understand that quite well. And Scott Sims went on to play in the NBA.
For the Spurs.
Now, did you play any other sports other than tennis at Kirksville? Did you play basketball with him?
I would say I played basketball with him, but it's more like he toyed with me. I mean, Scott Sims was a first-class basketball player.
He was a terrific basketball player. We used to play. I mean, I grew up in Macon, and people know this, so I can remember fondly playing Scott Sims, and he was, you know, always going to score a lot. We held him to 10 points one day, and we thought that was a terrific accomplishment.
Well, it was, since he averaged over 20. But you know, the funny thing about Scott, we would play, and he was really the only guy in Kirksville to play. I mean, there just weren't that many people. And then one summer, he sprained his right wrist, and he couldn't play me for 3 weeks. And at the time, my tennis serve was pitiful. Mm. Well, again, not a lot to do in Kirksville, so I picked up about 100 tennis balls and practiced my serve, a couple thousand serves a day for 3 weeks, and developed a serve which without that, I would not have played college tennis, and I wouldn't have continued to play competitive tennis since then, and it's always been my thanks to Scott hurting his wrist, I was able to become a pretty good tennis player. Yeah,
very neat. And where did you play tennis in Kirksville. And I don't want to get to playing tennis here because I bet I watched you. I think I probably watched you when I was in college here.
Well, it was at the college at Pershing Fieldhouse.
Yep.
Isn't that right?
Yep.
They had two tennis courts next to it between the building and the street, which was La Harper. Well, I don't remember what the name of the street was. But there were two tennis courts there, and that's almost exclusively where I played.
Was there any doubt that you were going to come to the University of Missouri, or did you consider going to other places?
There was no doubt. I always wanted – I've loved Columbia. I hated moving to Kirksville, frankly. Wanted to come back here, and we moved back the week after I graduated from high school.
Hmm. So men's tennis at the University of Missouri, I can't remember when it ended.
81 or 82.
All right, so you would have been on the tennis courts. Were you playing your tennis matches where now there is a parking lot, but for a while it was where the band used to practice?
Oh, behind Hearns?
Yeah.
No. So we played the tennis team played behind Brewer Fieldhouse. There were 16 or 18 tennis courts, and those were our tennis courts. They built six tennis courts behind Hearns that were dedicated about a week before I graduated.
Mm.
So I never got to play on those courts.
I think I saw that's where I know the courts you're talking about. They're not there anymore. That
right.
When you're next to Brewer and the courts, the other ones that they dedicated are not there anymore also.
Right.
But I did go out there at one point in time and see a couple of MU tennis matches out there.
Yeah, those are the ones behind Hearns were really nice tennis courts.
Yeah. So. I played on the ones next to Brewer just, you know, recreationally for fun of it. So tennis is one of those lifelong sports. I mean, people
yep.
talk about things that you could do. You're not going to play football well into, I mean, you can play a form of football, I suppose, and basketball is pretty hard. But tennis is one of those things that you can find somebody to play. You only need one, two, or three people, and you can play doubles or you can play singles with one other person. You can find courts pretty easily. So you just continue to play.
Yeah, I do. Still play tournaments.
So where has it taken you?
A couple of weeks ago, I was in Baton Rouge playing in a what's called a Category 2 national tournament. I've played for the United States in Turkey, in England, in Paris, in Canada, and in the United States.
Do you know, is it age category now?
That's what I play. Well, I play two different types of events. My primary focus is age group tennis.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the 60s now, so I'm playing... trying to play national tournaments against people who are at least 60 years old. There's another kind of tennis that is a team tennis concept, and some people in Kansas City asked me to play on their team. It's only doubles, and you play on weekends, and you try to go to a national final as a team.
This is broadening the scope beyond your experience as a tennis player, but it's asking more of the tennis atmosphere in Columbia. Your opinion and your evaluation of the tennis atmosphere here, because many people who are listening to this program would say, well, Rockbridge always wins the state high school girls and boys tennis tournament, so it must be pretty good. How do you evaluate what happens here, not just the high school level, but I'm talking about men and women who are tennis players in this community? What do we have strong and what do we have, what could we use more of?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. I mean, because the men's program doesn't exist, no longer exists at the University of Missouri, there's no influx of male tennis players, mm-hmm. good male. When I'm saying tennis players, I'm talking about competition tennis, which is not recreation tennis.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true at the women's side. We do have a women's program at the University of Missouri, and so some of the women who come here stay here and they teach, and having a group of adults teaching younger kids to play tennis is a really good thing, and it's a critically important thing if you want to have a tennis community, an active, vibrant tennis community. And we've been blessed with a number of really good coaches in Columbia who have done an outstanding job teaching young kids how to play tennis. And then we have, an icon in Ben Loeb, the Rockbridge High School tennis coach, who's the most successful high school tennis coach in Missouri high school history. And he has a way of attracting athletes to play tennis, which is absolutely remarkable. And it's resulted in a legacy. I mean, year after year after year, they're among the best teams in the state.
Yeah, but your point is a good one also, because of the males, there's no reason for them. I mean, they can't stay here and play tennis because there's no tennis team here. If they're going to be good enough to go and play at a college, they're going to obviously go out of town.
Right. And every once in a while, you get an outlier. There was a Vijay Armitage. You may remember that name. Mm-hmm. You may not. He was a professional tennis player from India. His nephew, Steve Armitage, was dating an MU co-ed. And he would come into town to see his girlfriend and would want to play tennis. And mm-hmm. I met him and was able to hit with him. He was playing professionally only in doubles, but always a lot of fun to find people like that.
In addition to that, and we'll wrap up this segment in a moment and move on to talk about other things, but you know, this is one of those corny questions that I hesitate and am embarrassed to ask. Who have you played famous people? Tennis? You've run across them?
I have, but nobody you would recognize.
Yeah.
The national tournaments I play every blue moon, a recognized name will enter that type of tournament. But typically, the pros once they get out of professional tennis, don't gravitate into our collection of people. But yeah, there are Roscoe Tanner has played. People might remember that name. Mm-hmm. He's played in a few tournaments.
It's interesting because you would be, you know, and I'm saying this in all seriousness and respect. You, I think people understand we're talking tennis. We're talking really good tennis. What is there? I mean, did you ever consider trying to go pro? Did you ever say, I'm going to try to make my life out of this?
You know, I couldn't. I mean, you've got to be... What you can't appreciate watching professional tennis on TV is the athleticism, is the speed. And in any professional sport, you have to have a set of wheels. I mean, you really have to be exceptionally fast. That's just for starters. And that's nobody has ever said Skip Walter and fast in the same sentence in the history of the English language. So I didn't have the skills. I mean, I didn't have the athletic talent to play at the professional level and be successful.
And that's what my point that I was trying to make is, here you are a really good tennis player, but anybody who goes pro, be it a baseball player, be it a tennis player, golfer, any of these things, there is that level. So anybody who says Skip Walter is like the best tennis player I could never stay on the court with him. And then you're saying that next level gives you an idea of what the elite athlete really is, that's beyond, which is really, really good athletes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's you don't appreciate that on TV, but mm-hmm. those guys, I mean, they're faster than you can imagine.
Mm. Skip Walter is our guest. I promise we're leaving tennis behind. We're going to move on to something else unless it just happens to pop up later on in this program. Well, we'll take a break and we'll come back. It's the Heritage Show. Again, Skip Walter is our guest. You're listening to News Talk 1400 KFRU.
This is the KFRU Heritage Series. More coming up on News Talk 1400, KFRU. This is the KFRU Heritage Series, celebrating people and events that have helped shape Columbia and Boone County.
Skip Walter is our guest. We spent the first segment talking about his early life of Kirksville and then coming to Columbia. So you went to school at MU, and you knew all along that you wanted to be, and we also talked about tennis in the first segment, but you came here to play tennis, but also, did you know you wanted to be an attorney?
No. I kind of thought that maybe that's what I wanted to do, but going through undergrad, you know, you're pulled in so many different directions. You have so many different interests, and it wasn't immediately apparent to me that that's what I wanted to do.
So what was the transformation, or path like to get to that point?
Well, I graduated in 75 and began teaching tennis professionally, moved to St. Joe, and after a few months of doing that, realized that maybe...
Wait a minute. You said what you said about Kirksville. I can imagine what you're going to say about St. Joe.
Yeah, well, I can tell you about St. Joe. So after a few months, I realized I didn't want to be a professional tennis teacher, and that's when I decided I wanted to go to law school. So I applied at a few schools and... ultimately was accepted at the University of Missouri and came back here to Columbia and went to law school.
Yeah, memories of people you went to law school with or professors or people who you think, wow, these people really impacted my life and helped me to want to have a passion to do what you've done for a long time now.
Oh, a ton. The professors we had at MU Law School were legends in the legal community. We had one professor... William Fratcher, who was a Nuremberg prosecutor.
Mm.
We had other professors who wrote the authoritative treatises on contracts, on torts, on civil procedure, on real estate finance. So we had, at the time I went to law school, a faculty that was as good as any faculty in the United States, at least in my opinion.
What was the law school like? Was it Tate Hall at that time?
It was Tate Hall.
It's been redone since then.
Yeah, and yeah, it has
and
been.
And there's a new building also.
That's been interesting. So Tate Hall at the time, there were like 450 students and maybe five classrooms. When class change occurred, all 450 people were basically on the first floor in one hallway, and it was, I mean, you were packed in like sardines. So you really had little choice but to meet everybody in your class, in the class above you, in the class below you, because you're right next to them for 10 minutes. Just to make it 50 feet across the hall, it took 10 minutes. So that was, but that was fun. I mean, socially, it was a gas. And to this day, some of my law school classmates are still my best friends. We maintain constant contact and collaborate on cases, talk about cases. And so, but Tate Hall was I really enjoyed it. The new law school is much bigger. You don't have that type of experience. You're not forced to talk to other people like we were at Tate Hall. But it's a beautiful building. But I have very good memories of Tate Hall. And interestingly, the last few years I've been teaching estate planning to financial planning students at the university, and they gave me a choice of different buildings last year, and one of the choices was a room in Tate Hall, which I had jumped on because I was able to go back to Tate Hall and actually teach a subject.
But how much of it has changed? Because they gutted that building a few years ago.
The walls were the only things that remained. The interior of the building is unrecognizable.
So were there any classmates that have gone on to other areas that made a name for themselves elsewhere? I suppose there are a lot of those.
There are. There are some people who became advisors to various presidents. One of my best friends, Pat Stark, followed me as president of the Missouri Bar in my law school class. And there are a number of highly competent, very professional attorneys out of our class.
When you were when you came back to Columbia and when you're going through college, what were the places that you'd like to spend time when you weren't, I mean, probably all the time in the law library, you know, and you're probably just always there, but ever escape from campus activities? Where'd you like to hang out?
Well, in undergrad and in law school, you know, campus activities were kind of what you did. So there were movies at Jesse Hall or concerts at Jesse Hall. You know, there was the normal Harpo's and Ford's Theater type activities, but you know, it's kind of what the undergrads do today.
Yeah, not much different in 40 years ago or so.
I don't think so.
That was when you got out of law school. What did you go into?
Well, as soon as I got out of law school, I went into the prosecutor's office. Joe Mosley hired me, and I actually was able to try a jury trial the second day on the job.
How do you do that?
Well, I got Ellen Roper, Judge Roper, swore me in in front of my uncle, and she read the entire oath of office that you've got to take, and she said, "Repeat after me," and she read the entire oath, and I said, can you break that down just a little bit? My uncle was laughing and laughing and laughing. But so she swore me in so I could do this trial the following day, because the Supreme Court swearing-in ceremony was like a couple of weeks away, and I had to do this jury trial. So I just got thrown into the mix,
How do you prepare a trial in one day?
Well, I'd
prepare
been
for a trial.
I was licensed the day before I tried the case, but I'd been working there for a couple of weeks, so I had time.
How long were you with the prosecuting office there?
2.5 years. I got out in June of 1982, and then went to work with Herb Wilbrand and Dan Simon and Ross Stroop at what was called Brown Wilbrand and Simon at the time. Worked there for 6 years and then opened my own office in 1988. And I've basically been working in essentially the same office since then. I've got a couple of partners.
I wasn't here in the early 80s when you would have been a part of the county prosecuting office. What were there big news trials at that point in time, or something that was an attention getter there during that period?
Oh, we had some. Yeah. Mosley did, of course, the high profile trials. And there were several murder trials that he had to try. One of the most interesting trials I had was a forged prescription case oddly enough. But it involved a guy named Doyle Williams, who had murdered a doctor in Ovaz, Dr. Doman, and then he'd also murdered a guy named Brummett just in the river, just outside of Jeff City, also in Callaway County. Both of those murders happened in Callaway County. We were not completely convinced that Williams would be prosecuted successfully on either one of those two charges. And so I pursued this forged prescription case and ultimately was able to get a life sentence on him. He was eventually executed for the murders. He was convicted of the Brummett murder, I believe. Well, he's convicted of both, but he was given the death sentence for the Brummett murder.
Was he the one, because I read in preparation for my time in interviewing you on the Heritage Show, that was he the one that killed a witness?
Yes, that was Doman. He had stolen a prescription pad from Doman's office in Ovaz, and thinking that if he killed Doman, nobody could testify that the forgery wasn't Doman's signature. I mean, how stupid is that? Mm-hmm. He executed basically Dr. Doman. Well, you know, every pharmacist in Columbia knows Dr. Doman's signature. A handwriting expert at the Highway Patrol could testify to that.
Whether he's alive or dead.
Dr. Doman's wife could testify that was not his signature. I mean, it was so simple. It was really, you know, it just shows some criminals are just not particularly bright.
I'm always curious as to, as an attorney, you have something like that, which would have been, and I don't use this flippantly, but like an adrenaline rush in a way. I mean, that is one where you had a lot of attention being paid to that. It had a lot of elements that would be something that you could really see a lot of news stories on and see things. You know, it's kind of like what you would see on an episode of Law and Order or something like that, which didn't exist at that point in time. How do you do the regular days when you have those moments of like high intensity? I better be on my best for these kinds of events.
Well, it's your job. Yeah. And I, you know, prosecution is a lot of fun. I mean, it's varied because if you walk into your office, you're going to get 10 or 15 or I don't know how many police reports they get today. But every day you get a new set of police reports, new charges, and you have to decide whether to charge somebody with a crime or not. The police don't get that opportunity. They mm-hmm. can arrest people and they can prepare police reports, but they do not file criminal charges against defendants. That's what the prosecutor does. And so you take a set of facts that are given to you through this police report, and you have to make a judgment as to whether or not you believe this person committed a crime and whether they should stand trial for that crime. And so it's a very important job. It's a job that obviously affects the lives, the freedom of a variety of people. It affects victims. And so the importance is not lost. And so regardless of the profile of the case, every case has a victim, almost every case has a victim who is very interested in the outcome. Almost every case has a defendant who is very interested in the outcome.
In the prosecuting attorney's office, and I would imagine that each person would run it his or her own way, but did you, when you come in and you look at what is on the table as far as the possibilities are, is that a group effort or is it individually decided? Do you sit down like maybe an editorial board was set on a newspaper and say, okay, here are the stories we're going after today? Did you sit down as a group and say, all right, which ones make sense? And let me hear the pros and cons of each one.
Mostly it was an individual decision. Hmm. Mostly every lawyer had their own set of crimes for which they were responsible. So when I became first assistant, I was responsible for some serious felonies. And if there was a potential for that type of charge, I got the police report and I made a decision. However, obviously, I've got other associates in the office, and I had Mosley as the elected official. When there was a question, it was certainly appropriate and expected that there would be some collaboration because the other lawyers in the office were very competent professional attorneys, and getting their opinion was always a good thing. And Mosley is very bright and a great deal of common sense and a great deal of political savvy. And so getting his analysis for filing decisions was always a good thing.
Let me see if I can clearly kind of transition into something I'm curious about. Maybe as the president of the Missouri Bar, you might have had this. I think you had this perhaps as part of what was very important to you. But my connection between the prosecuting attorney's office and then judgeships in this state. I like the Missouri plan personally. I think it's a wise plan. My question, though, is hearing you describe what happens in a prosecutor's office would lead, I think, at times, certain prosecutors, and again, I'm not asking any particular prosecutors, I'm not trying to put you on the spot with specific ones, but there is an element of politics into what an elected prosecuting attorney does, it would seem to me, in what cases he or she takes or doesn't take, and the emphasis put on those. So that could be a political thing, and I think sometimes that is accused of prosecutors, no matter where they are. And I'll get a comment on that first before we move in then to trying to keep the political emphasis out of judgeships.
Okay. Well, it absolutely, charging decisions in virtually every prosecuting attorney's office involves an element of politics. I don't think that's a bad thing. Because the political consideration essentially translates to the public interest and the public, what the public sees is an important decision to make, and so looking at the politics, assuming that you're also looking at the legal side of things, and I'm confident that that virtually every prosecutor does that. That's not a bad thing to take into consideration the political consequences. But once you do that, now you're stuck with the system, and you've got, as a prosecutor, you have to prove a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt, either to a judge or to a jury. And at that point in time, the political considerations in filing are totally insignificant.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, because I would think that sometimes it could go into plea bargaining, it could go into other elements, and then also, again, what resources or what you're willing to do and how to use sometimes, or, and I don't like the word manipulate, but how to use the case for the benefit of someone who knows I am hired because I was elected.
Well, it's a complex process.
Uh-huh.
As a prosecutor, there may be the elected official may say to his assistants, "Look, we want to get tough on DWIs. We want to get tough on stealings. We want to get tough on drug offenses. Whatever the offenses are, and we're going to go after a punishment consistently." That shows the public that we're getting tough on this particular crime. So they have a right to do that. That's their job. What considerations they take they use to advance the interests of what they perceive to be the public's interest. As a defense attorney, it's your job, if you don't like where they're going, it's your job to convince the prosecutor to deviate from that policy. And that's where the system becomes so helpful. It's an adversarial system. You've got defense attorneys whose job it is to do the best job they can to serve the interests of their client, and so there's this constant give and take. Then you have the fortunate fact that the prosecutors aren't the judges at the same time. Mm-hmm. They're not the juries. They don't get to make the ultimate call. They can make recommendations. So then you get into an interplay of the facts and the law and whether somebody is a good trial attorney or not a good trial attorney, and who makes a good witness, who doesn't make a good witness. So it's a very complex process.
Skip Walther is our guest. I'm going to extend this segment just a little bit longer because while we're on this subject, I want to move then to what I think I read in some prep material. This is something that's important to you. Was it a part of what you wanted to accomplish as the president of Missouri Bar? And is it something that you're still very much opinionated about, and that would be the politics in the judgeships in this particular state?
Absolutely. It's always going to be an issue for us. And having fair and impartial judges is critically important to every citizen in the state of Missouri. And there are those who don't want fair and impartial judges, I'm sorry to say. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that the system of judicial selection in Missouri is as good as it can get. And I'm very much a defender of our current system.
So there's pressure, though, to change that.
There always is.
Always the pressure to change that.
Right.
What would you say should be a warning flag to those of us who are not a part of the legal profession to say, folks, what you just said, we have the best system that seems to be out there. And so why, if somebody wants to change that, to me, that would say they want to change it because they want to do something that is troubling.
Well, of course, it's a messaging issue. And fortunately, our system of judicial selection is a constitutional system. to change that would require a vote of everybody in the state of Missouri. So it isn't just that one party or another in control of Jeff City can affect the outcome, because that's not the case. The citizens of the state of Missouri get to decide whether or not we have our current system, or whether we deviate from it. So for us, you know, we believe that our system promotes a fair and impartial judiciary. The other side would probably say the same thing,
mm-hmm.
And would try to create a message that resonates with the voting public. And so that's the challenge that we face, because there's no clear. The future is not that clear.
Every once in a while, we'll hear ads. I mean, we have ads that run on this radio station that would say we have to change the system, and they charge or they accuse the system that is existing now as being corrupt, but they want to replace it with something that I think from common sense would say is even more corruptible.
Well, it's political. I mean, that's every change that's been promoted since in the last 6 or 7 years has been a change to a more political system. And what I find so ironic, the current complaint is that trial lawyers are in control of the judicial selection system in Missouri. Well, as president of the Missouri Bar, I was fortunate to meet presidents of other states, and there's a guy, George Fair, who was the president of the Mississippi Bar when I was president of the Missouri Bar. Well, in Mississippi, they elect their judges. And I said, George, why hasn't Mississippi gone to a merit-based judicial selection system like Missouri has? He goes, well, the trial attorneys would never stand for it.
Huh.
I go, what are you talking about? He says, well, the trial attorneys have figured out how to elect judges in the state of Mississippi, and they don't want to go to a merit-based system because they may lose control.
Diminish their power.
How ironic that the opposite argument is being
made. Just go, you can use the same, that is strange. That is a strange one where you just change states and you would hear the same argument on the completely opposite system.
Right.
Skip Walther is our guest. We'll take a break and we'll come back. One more short segment to go. This is the Heritage Show on KFRU.
This is the KFRU Heritage Series. More coming up on News Talk 1400, KFRU. This is the KFRU Heritage Series, celebrating people and events that have helped shape Columbia and Boone County.
We'll finish our Heritage Show interview with Skip Walther in this segment. And Skip Walther, I appreciate, first of all, you coming in to do this. And then I want to move on away from your profession so much. And then also your talent as a tennis player also, which we covered in earlier segments. And just talk about your interest in Columbia. You said earlier you love Columbia. You came back for Columbia. You ran for mayor of Columbia within the last year or so of this recording of this program. What is it about Columbia that enthuses you and makes you like this community so much?
Well, growing up, I had a lot of friends. I've always enjoyed what Columbia has to offer. I spent a great deal of time at Stevens Lake Park, swimming at Southwest Swim Club, swimming, playing softball, playing soccer, basketball, you name it. They're just all kinds of activities. And Columbia, with the university, with the young demographic that we have here, invites all type of arts experiences, and so Columbia has always had a lot to offer, and I've always appreciated the growth of Columbia, because with growth comes new experiences, whether it's in the arts or whether it's in business or whether it's recreational or sports or what have you. The growth of Columbia, I think, has been a really positive thing.
You have put time into that. You've represented people that have helped Columbia grow, and you've been an advocate for them. You've been in front of the city council and other with neighborhoods trying to say, hey, this is what we've got. This seems to be something that makes sense. You know that we like to compartmentalize groups as to growth or anti-growth. It seems to me like growth is going to happen. So what is your philosophy on how to make Columbia a good place for those who are concerned about the growth and those who say this is a vibrant community where this is going to be growth that we want to see happen?
Communication is vitally important in any aspect of life, and I think where we've gone astray in the last few years. And one of the reasons I ran for mayor is because I thought that there was a lack of communication between the groups that you just mentioned. And I thought that I might be able to facilitate a more objective conversation about the path for Columbia moving forward into the future. Growth is an inevitable consequence of Columbia's educational institutions, of its healthcare institutions, its centrality within the state of Missouri on I-70 and US 63. So, with those elements, people are going to gravitate to Columbia, to Boone County, from the outlying counties that don't have the healthcare, don't have the education, don't have the recreation or the sports facilities that we have, and so it's going to happen. And burying our heads in the sand and arguing against it and not talking to each other is the wrong approach, in my view.
Let me ask you this before we're out of time, and it's kind of separate, but it's kind of related. When you were an elementary school kid in Columbia, or when you came back here right after graduating high school and you returned to Columbia, when you remember those days, did you ever in your wildest imagination imagine what we have as far as student apartments around downtown Columbia or the spread of Columbia for that matter and into the outlying perimeter of it?
Yeah, I'm not going to say I'm not going to say yes to that question, but I would say that I hoped that Columbia would grow. I appreciate the growth that Columbia has seen. And for me, it's a good thing. And I'll just very quickly hark back to my few months in St. Joe. I went to a party with at the Wyeth estate. The Wyeth family in St. Joe was a big deal. Trucking mm-hmm. Wyeth. One of the Wyeth kids I was talking to, and I said, so St. Joe hasn't really moved anywhere from a demographic or a population standpoint for several decades. In fact, they were dropping. I said, what's going on with that? And he said, well, the founding fathers in St. Joe rejected the idea of a bridge, the first bridge across the Missouri River, because they didn't want the competition that would eventually inevitably follow with the bridge would come commerce and competition for the city fathers. Hmm. So they said, no, it went to Kansas City and the rest is history. Well, I said, well, so what is it about this attitude? And the guy said, well, St. Joe, he said, St. Joe is a town of 80,000 people waiting to die. And when he said that, I thought, you know, that's not really my idea of a successful city. And so it's always, and I remember that quote. I just don't think that an anti-growth attitude is a healthy attitude.
Well, we'll have to end with that. I appreciate that. Thank you very much for taking time to join us on
the
program.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Skip Walter, who has been our guest. That's the Heritage Show this week. Back with another one in the week to come. This is KFRU.
You've been listening to the KFRU Heritage Series with David Lyle. It's a one-hour perspective on the events and the people whose lives have contributed to the heritage of Boone County. Listen each Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. as we celebrate those who have become part of our history. The KFRU Heritage Series. News Talk 1400, KFRU, Columbia.